Hello, I'm Richard Burnip, and for the next 25 minutes, I'm going to talk a little bit about Sherlock Holmes and, equally, if not more importantly, Arthur Conan Doyle, his creator. And in particular, things that were going on in the springtime, around April and May, in 1891, and 10 years later, in 1901. Doyle and Holmes have always been around for me. My father had all the Sherlock Holmes stories and the Professor Challenger stories on the shelf within easy reach. And if there was ever a Holmes movie or TV show on, we'd generally watch it when I was growing up. At university, I had the chance to specialise in early detective fiction. And as an actor, well, I've played Dr. Watson on stage and also narrated the audiobook versions of Robert Ryan's wonderful quartet of Dr. Watson novels. I've done a bit of writing and the occasional lecture about Holmes and Doyle as well, and contributed to the Sherlock Holmes Journal. I suppose it was inevitable when I was introduced to London walks that one of the first walks I was asked to learn was the Sherlock Holmes walk, and that was quite a while ago. And there are now several Holmes and Doyle walks that I do. Partly because Holmes and Doyle are all over London, and you never really run out of things to talk about, and there's always something new to learn. Two stories in particular I'm going to concentrate on. The Final Problem, the one that introduced Professor Moriarty, and The Hound of the Baskervilles. You could be forgiven for wondering why I'm talking about them in connection with London. After all, famously, The Final Problem ends in Switzerland at the Reichenbach waterfall, where Holmes and Moriarty fight to the death. And of course, The Hound of the Baskervilles takes place in that most atmospheric setting in the west of England, Dartmoor. But both of them have a great deal to do with London. And although the stories were written several years apart, they're linked by a particular date, May the 4th. I'll come back to that in a bit. A few weeks in the spring of 1891 transformed Arthur Conan Doyle's life. He spent most of the 1880s as a provincial doctor in Southsea, in Hampshire, on the south coast. He got married there. His first daughter was born there. But by the end of 1890, he'd decided on a career change. He'd already become quite a prolific writer in his spare time. Doyle had had his first short story published way back in 1879, when he was still a student. And right the way through the 1880s, he'd been writing and writing and writing. By 1890, he'd written some novels as well, including the first two Sherlock Holmes novels, A Study in Scarlet and The Sign of Four, but these were just among the many things he was writing. He had no grand plan at that point of turning Holmes and Watson into some kind of huge saga. In fact, at the end of The Sign of Four, Watson is moving out of Baker Street because he's fallen in love with their client, Mary Morstan. He's going to get married. And the story arc of Holmes and Watson's adventures has come to an end after just two novels. Obviously, it didn't. But it was a variety of things that conspired to make Holmes and Watson famous. So at the end of 1890, Doyle packs up his practice and heads off to Vienna, because his plan is that if he's going to continue with his medical career, he's going to become a specialist. He's going to specialise in ophthalmology, and Vienna is one of the key places in the world to attend lectures in the human eye. He's in Vienna for just over 2 months. He writes a short novel while he's out there, so there's some debate as to how many lectures he actually attended. But by the end of March, he's back in London, and probably already been working on a Sherlock Holmes story. Not a novel this time, but a short story. A short story with a very specific target in mind. Before Doyle left for Vienna, a new magazine had hit the bookstalls, The Strand magazine, an illustrated monthly magazine, which promised its readers, among other things, the best in modern short stories. While Doyle was away, his literary agent had sent a random short story he'd written to the magazine. They liked it. They published it in their third issue. Encouraged by this, Doyle has the brainwave of putting Holmes and Watson, characters he's very familiar with, into short story format. By the 3rd of April, Doyle is in lodgings in Montague Place at the back of the British Museum, and he has a long walk every day to and from his consulting room, which is at No. 2 Upper Wimpole Street in Marylebone. Doyle's lodgings in Montague Place are long gone, but No. 2 Upper Wimpole Street is very much still there and has a commemorative plaque to Doyle on it. Doyle had a consulting room in the building and shared a waiting room with other practitioners. He later said his consulting room turned out to be a waiting room as well because he didn't really get any patients. Whether there were no patients or very few coming to consult this unknown specialist, it certainly left Doyle with time on his hands. He'd already finished this first Sherlock Holmes short story, A Scandal in Bohemia, and sent it off to his agent on the 3rd of April. His agent sent it to the Strand. The editor loved Doyle's storytelling and his clear handwriting as well. So with time on his hands in his consulting room, it's perhaps not surprising that by the end of April, Doyle has written another 3 Sherlock Holmes short stories, among them The Red-Headed League. At the beginning of May, he's working on what would be the 5th of these short stories for The Strand, The 5 Orange Pips. It's a very sad story. John Openshaw, having been to consult Sherlock Holmes, and he's a completely innocent young man, he's committed no crime whatsoever. He's murdered on his way home before the investigation even gets underway. And Holmes's mission becomes not solving things for his client, but avenging his client. It's a story that isn't adapted very often, partly because it doesn't end in a dramatic way directly. Holmes identifies the murderers, but they've escaped. But their ship is lost at sea. Divine justice has overtaken them. It's been suggested that that was a story that Doyle gave up on, that he went down the pub and couldn't be bothered to think of a decent ending for it. But in fact, it was a story that he almost died writing. On the 4th of May, 1891, Doyle set off to walk from Montague Place to his consulting room. He'd have to cross through Bloomsbury, Fitzrovia, and into Marylebone. It would take him quite a while to get there. That morning, he didn't get there. He was suddenly taken ill with a terrible bout of influenza. For several days, he was bedridden. It almost killed him. And as he began to recover, he made the decision to give up full-time medicine and concentrate on his writing. In fact, as he wrote later, he determined with a wild rush of joy to cut the painter and trust forever to my power of writing. And so he settled down with a stout heart, as he said, to do some literary work worthy of the name. I think he can be forgiven for not giving Sherlock Holmes a dramatic conclusion to The 5 Orange Pips. But that date, the 4th of May, 1891, stuck in his mind clearly, because a couple of years later, it's the date he gives in The Final Problem to the fateful encounter between Holmes and Moriarty at the Reichenbach Falls. It's probably not a coincidence. In that story, which was first published in the Christmas issue of The Strand in 1893, to the dismay of a lot of fans of Sherlock Holmes, who had no warning that he was going to disappear into a watery grave, there are some lovely scenes in London before they depart for Switzerland. Holmes has been investigating Professor Moriarty's criminal network, and Moriarty is on to him, has warned him off, and when Holmes, saying things like, "Danger is part of my trade," refuses to be put off, Moriarty immediately has 3 attempts made on his life. Here's one of them, as Holmes describes it. "I went out about midday to transact some business in Oxford Street. As I passed the corner which leads from Bentinck Street onto the Welbeck Street crossing, a 2-horse van, furiously driven, whizzed round and was on me like a flash. I sprang for the footpath and saved myself by the fraction of a second. The van dashed round by Marylebone Lane and was gone in an instant." We retrace those steps, in fact, cautiously, of course, on one of the Sherlock Holmes walks. But there's a glorious moment in London in that story that belongs not to Holmes, but to Dr. Watson in particular. Holmes and Watson are supposed to be rendezvousing at Victoria Station to catch the boat train, the service that links with ferries to the continent, leave the police to round up Moriarty's gang and, in theory, get out of harm's way. Holmes makes his own way to Victoria, disguised as an elderly Italian priest, naturally enough, and he gives Watson very strict instructions about what he needs to do to avoid being followed, various timings and routes. And part of that route involves him being dropped by a cab at the Strand end of the Lowther Arcade and running through to the other end. There he sees a small brougham driven by a driver whose black cloak has a red-tipped collar. Leaping into that vehicle, the driver immediately takes him to Victoria Station. The driver turns out, in fact, to be Holmes's elder brother Mycroft, in what has to be a rare, possibly unique, burst of energy from the elder brother, because Mycroft prefers to stay in his club, or in his lodgings, or in his government department. A visit to Baker Street, in one of the later stories, Holmes describes as being like a tram car coming down a country lane. Mycroft has his rails and runs on them. But it's nice to know that when the chips are down, Mycroft is prepared to not just get out and about, but actually get actively involved. The thing about the Lowther Arcade is that it vanished in 1904. But you can still just spot where the entrance to it was at one end, not on the Strand, not on the obvious bit, but around the other end, the bit where Dr. Watson emerged, the bit where Mycroft was waiting to drive him off. It's in Adelaide Street, at the back of St. Martin in the Fields, and I never pass that spot without thinking of Mycroft and Watson. But I set out to talk about The Hound of the Baskervilles. Well, why not? It's the most famous Sherlock Holmes story of them all. And one of the wonderful things, I think, about the evolution of that very famous novel is that, originally, it wasn't going to be a Sherlock Holmes story at all. For nearly 8 years, the public believed that Sherlock Holmes was dead. But Doyle had left a nice loophole at the end of the final problem in that the bodies of Holmes and Moriarty were never recovered from the waterfall. In 1901, he writes The Hound of the Baskervilles, not bringing Sherlock Holmes back to life, billed as a case from the archives, something Watson hadn't got around to telling us before. In 1900, during the Anglo-Boer War, Conan Doyle had gone out to South Africa as hospital administrator with the Langman Hospital, a privately funded hospital that was going out to the war zone. Doyle would have needed no encouragement to support medical staff in a crisis. He'd been there himself. The Langman Hospital ended up based in Bloemfontein at a time when the water supply had been cut off and enteric fever, a form of typhoid, was running riot through the population, both military and civilian. Doyle himself was taken ill, but came through, although it affected his health afterwards. By the time Doyle eventually came back to England later in 1900, he'd become good friends with a young journalist called Bertram Fletcher Robinson. And Robinson is the man who gives Doyle a lot of the ideas and background for the Dartmoor atmosphere of The Hound of the Baskervilles. And in the spring of 1901, Doyle is at work on this book, A Real Creeper. And suddenly, round about the beginning of May, actually, don't know exactly when, but at some point, Doyle decides to change his plan with the book and turn it into a Sherlock Holmes novel. The Strand magazine double his fee as a result, because a new Sherlock Holmes story will be a big event. If you think how impatient people were during the final novels of Harry Potter, when is the next one coming out and so on, or how impatient people are with George R.R. Martin and so on. Well, Doyle not only made his public wait 8 years for a new Sherlock Holmes adventure, but allowed them in the end to spend a decade thinking he was dead. Now, nobody seems to know for sure what prompted Doyle to turn it into a Sherlock Holmes novel. There could have been all kinds of factors. One factor may have been the success of the first official Sherlock Holmes play. Doyle had given carte blanche to the American playwright and star actor William Gillette to create a Sherlock Holmes play, after various false starts with other producers. And Gillette crafted this immensely popular, hugely successful melodrama, which had debuted in America in 1899, and that was due to come to England late in 1901. In fact, when it opened in London with Gillette recreating this role, which he'd recreate for years on and off, he performed at the Lyceum Theatre, which I'll come to in a moment. So maybe that was one factor. The Sherlock Holmes play was a success. The appetite for Holmes was still there. But that spring, this is just a little bit of speculation, that spring, Conan Doyle became a member of the Athenaeum Club on Waterloo Place, just around the corner from the Reform Club, which he joined nearly a decade earlier, and not far from where the fictional Diogenes Club would be located if it really existed, Mycroft Holmes's club. On April the 30th, midway through work on The Hound of the Baskervilles, Doyle gives a dinner at the Athenaeum. He has 11 guests and all kinds of distinguished men who are part of this, including Winston Churchill, who of course had been out in South Africa like Doyle and who had been taken prisoner and escaped. Churchill at the dawn of his political career. Also at the dinner were Doyle's author friends J.M. Barrie and Anthony Hope. And it's very tempting to think that one of them might have said to Doyle, well, why don't you put Sherlock Holmes into that book? I guess we'll probably never know. And maybe Winston Churchill already has enough to his credit without without being the man who put Holmes into The Hound of the Baskervilles. However, whatever the inspiration, The Hound of the Baskervilles begins serialization that autumn. And in London, readers of the Strand magazine get the first installment where Holmes and Watson have a visitor to Baker Street, Dr. Mortimer, now a provincial doctor out on Dartmoor, but formerly a surgeon, a young surgeon at Charing Cross Hospital. It's no coincidence that part of the team of that hospital out in Bloemfontein, who worked in such terrible circumstances, and a man who Doyle became great friends with, was a young surgeon from Charing Cross Hospital, Charles Gibbs, who had a very long and distinguished career. He's got to be one of the ingredients that make Dr. Mortimer. Dr. Mortimer it is who tells Holmes and Watson the legend of the Hound of the Baskervilles. In fact, he's brought the story. He's brought the document that gives the old legend. He kick-starts the whole thing. Charing Cross Hospital, of course, if you look it up today, it's now out in West London. But in Doyle's day, in Charles Gibbs's day and Dr. Mortimer's day, it was just round the corner from the Strand. It's where Charing Cross Police Station now is. There's a good deal of action in London, in The Hound of the Baskervilles. A famous scene in Regent Street, where Holmes and Watson catch a glimpse of a mysterious man with a black beard in a cab who's following Dr. Mortimer and Sir Henry Baskerville. Well, it's quite early on, so it's some time later in the book when we finally learn the identity of the man behind the beard. But of course, The Hound of the Baskervilles being serialised, 1901 to 1902, it's a marketing person's dream today that it coincides with William Gillette coming to England to play his Sherlock Holmes play at the Lyceum Theatre. And this must have been a very special time for Doyle. Not only was The Hound of the Baskervilles very successful, Gillette's play was greatly loved, but the Lyceum Theatre itself was a really important building for Doyle. After all, it was one of the first places he'd ever visited on his very first visit to London. Christmas 1874, he came down to stay with relatives. He was 15 years old, and one of his uncles took him to the Lyceum Theatre to see Henry Irving playing Hamlet. And Doyle thought Irving was a wonderful actor. And there's probably more than a little ingredient or two from Henry Irving that goes into the pot to create Sherlock Holmes. But one of the lovely things about Doyle and the Lyceum is that within 20 years of being a rather starstruck teenager seeing this great actor, that same great actor was performing in one of Conan Doyle's plays, a play about Corporal Gregory Brewster, the last survivor of his regiment who once fought at the Battle of Waterloo. It was a great character part that Doyle had tailor-made for Henry Irving, and Henry Irving kept it in his repertoire to the end of his life. So, when you add William Gillette as Sherlock Holmes at the Lyceum as well, it becomes a very, very special place. And don't forget, years before, Conan Doyle had set a very important meeting outside the Lyceum Theatre, in the Sign of Four, when Holmes and Watson accompany Mary Morstan there for an important rendezvous. They're supposed to meet, by the way, at the third pillar from the left. But if you walk up to the Lyceum today, which still has its original frontage from the 1830s, you'll find it has six pillars. So the third pillar from the left, well, it depends on whether you're going into the theatre or out of the theatre. But if you stand right in the middle, you'll probably be in the right place. There's really no limit to the adventures of Conan Doyle and Sherlock Holmes in London. Just to finish with, here's a poem that Doyle wrote a couple of years before The Hound of the Baskervilles came along. But it shows he was thinking along those lines already. It's called The Old Huntsman. There's a keen and grim old huntsman on a horse as white as snow. Sometimes he is very swift and sometimes he is slow, but he never is at fault, for he always hunts at view, and he rides without a halt after you. The huntsman's name is Death, his horse's name is Time. He is coming, as I sit and write this rhyme. He is coming, as you read the rhyme I write. You can hear the hoof's slow drumming day and night. You can hear the distant drumming as the clock goes tick-a-tack, and the chiming of the hours is the music of his pack. You may hardly note their growling underneath the noonday sun, but at night you hear them howling as they run. And they never check or falter, for they never miss their kill. Seasons change and systems alter, but the hunt is running still. Hark, the evening chime is playing, o'er the long grey town it peals. Don't you hear the death hound baying at your heels? Where is there an earth or burrow, where a cover left for you? A year, a week, perhaps tomorrow, brings the huntsman's death halloo. Day by day he gains upon us, and the most that we can claim is that when the hounds are on us, we die game. And somewhere dwells the master, by whom it was decreed. He sent the savage huntsman, he bred the snow-white steed. These hounds which run forever, he set them on your track. He hears you scream, but never calls them back. He does not heed our suing, we never see his face. He hunts to our undoing, we thank him for the chase. We thank him and we flatter, we hope because we must. But have we cause? No matter. Let us trust. Let us trust, writes Doyle at the end there. In 1898, when that poem was published, Doyle had moved away from the Roman Catholic faith that he'd been brought up in, and it would be some years later that he finally found something that he trusted in absolutely. In fact, late in life he said, I'm not talking about what I believe, I'm not talking about what I think, I'm talking about what I know. And what he knew, and what he dedicated the last decade and a half of his life towards promoting, was the cause of spiritualism. That, of course, is another story. And in that slightly terrifying poem, the death hound baying at your heels and so on, there's quite a lot of the atmosphere of The Hound of the Baskervilles. Thank you for listening.